All right, this is June 17, 1998. We're interviewing a member of the City Council of the City of Edinburgh, Ofelia de los Santos. You've signed the deed of gift form, and you understand what the interview is about. So why don't I just ask you some specific questions first, and then we try to cover biography and childhood and political career.
Okay.
I'm interested in the political career, but these other questions are formative.
All right.
Who is the most effective Mexican-American political leader today?
Isn't it sad that you have to sit and think about that? Well, I'm sure there are some national figures. Locally, I could tell you at the drop of a hat.
Well, locally, who would that be?
Well, in this city, it's Mayor Joe Ochoa, who has been very instrumental in moving the city forward in the last 6 years.
Okay. And which organization among Mexican Americans is the most effective?
In terms of, national attention to the Hispanic issues, I'd have to say the National Council of La Raza. I don't think they do much but advocate at the Washington level. TAMAC, the Texas Association of Mexican American Chambers of Commerce, have an impact at the state level, at least in this state of Texas, in terms of lobbying for Hispanic issues. I wish I could say that LULAC was one of those, but I think its time has passed. At this point, I really can't tell you that there's one prominent one.
What is the most pressing issue facing Mexican Americans?
I think the most pressing issue has to do with our immigration problem and the way this country views it as a problem. I believe that there is a concerted effort to try to stop the flow of immigrants that are of Hispanic origin and to do away with our language. And evidence of that is what's happening in California and what has been trying to take root here in the state of Texas, which is to do away with bilingual education.
Black-brown relations, what are the underpinnings of tensions between blacks and browns?
I think there's still tension there, as there always will be, between two groups that are so strongly vying for a piece of the pie, that all-American pie that is ever so elusive. But I think that I am hopeful that we will be able to at some point merge into a significant political entity to be reckoned with. I don't know how far we are from that, but at least that's something I would work towards.
What are the underpinnings of tension between Chicanos and Mexicanos from Mexico?
In the valley, which is the area that I'm from, the Rio Grande Valley down here in South Texas, there's quite a bit of tension, and I'm constantly amazed at how soon people like myself, who are first generation Americans, Mexican Americans, so quickly turn against the newest immigrants. I don't know how to stop that. I don't know whether just educating people on their roots and their heritage would help. But I believe that down here we have quite a bit of discrimination now. Instead of the gringo discriminating against us, it's ourselves discriminating against the newest immigrants.
Underpinnings of tension between Chicanos and other Latinos, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Central Americans?
There is quite a bit, and I believe that a lot of it is economic. As you see, other Hispanic groups come over here that don't seem to be struggling as much as, say, Mexicans, then you're going to have those underpinnings of tension.
You're on the city council. Are you the first Mexican-American woman to get on the city council?
No, there was one other woman. Actually, there were two other women back in the early 80s. One was placed there by a political group, and she served one term and quickly got off.
What was her name?
Teodora Treviño.
Mm-hmm.
I believe maiden name is Iglesias. The second was Pearl Mathis, who was the publisher of our local paper. She was married to Jim Mathis, a staunch Democrat that ran the paper. And she served only one term as well. And again, she was placed there by a certain group.
How did you get there, and when did that happen, and how much money did you spend, and how did you do that?
In 1994, I ran for office here and was elected. I had two candidates. It was a vacancy, so it was easier than running against an incumbent. I saw that the city was headed in a positive direction. I saw the leadership that was formulating or that was forming in the city, and I was always curious as to see whether I could garner enough support to get myself elected. Having worked on so many campaigns for other people, I felt like it was time for me to test those waters. So I ran and took care of one opponent in the first race, and then had a runoff with another woman attorney as well. And that was a difficult. I spent $10,000.
Total?
Earned it all myself, brought it all in myself, total.
Who was the runoff opponent to be defeated?
A woman named Alicia Guerrero.
Was the win decisive or bare?
It was 355 votes, which for me is decisive because in our city of 34,000 inhabitants at that time, only 4,000 people bothered to vote in a city election.
So this is by districts or at large?
No, at large.
All the district seats in Edinburgh are at large?
At large. We don't have any. We're all Hispanic.
Okay. And you run for re-election?
Next year, 1999. I'm serving my second term.
Right, so you're talking about the second term or the first term?
The first term. The second term I was unopposed, 1996.
Did you raise any money?
$500 was donated without being solicited, and I threw a big party for my campaign workers.
How did you campaign? What did you go do? Did you register voters? Did you walk the streets? Did you have radio ads or newspaper ads or bumper stickers or lawn signs? What did you do?
I didn't register voters, but I was very organized. The first thing I did was I ordered some very professional 4x8 posters with my picture, because you need to understand that even though I was born here in Edinburgh, I had not lived here since I was 6 years old. So I had been back 3 years in my hometown when I decided to run. So a lot of people did not remember me and did not know me. So I sent off for some professional 4x8s with my picture, recruited my family, my husband and two other men, relatives, made all my signs. I had a total of 50 4x8 signs that went up all over the city. That's about enough to cover the city of Edinburgh, which is about 38 square miles. And I ordered some professional palm cards and then some smaller sticker cards, and just started walking the area. I divided up the city, of course, by precinct. We had a map, and then I organized a group of workers, mostly relatives. Some people had never been involved in politics before, and there were a few seasoned political workers, and that helped. I had a campaign manager, I had a separate treasurer, but basically I ran the campaign myself.
How do you do politics here? Do you have big parties? Do you have barbecues? Do you meet at coffee gatherings, or you walk streets? What do you do?
All of the above. You have to work the Anglo population a little bit differently. So there I utilized my neighbor, who is an Anglo Sandy man, who's also a lawyer, and is from an old family, established family in Edinburgh. So she volunteered to do a mail out. And so she did a very nice letter talking about me and who I was and endorsing me, basically. Then I targeted other women professionals, not just Anglos, but other women professionals, and had them endorse me with a picture and a publicity in the media. I went to several groups and asked for endorsements. Kiwanis, which I was a member of. I went to Rotary. I went to the Lions Club. In these small towns, like Edinburgh, you have a lot of these service groups. I did all of that. I went to one particular group in McAllen, Anthony Stanton, just a bunch of professional women, and they endorsed me, so I openly did that. And then with my professional friends, people that are like in the same income group as, say, professional lawyers and doctors, I had individual coffees. Then with the gente from the east side, which is where I was born and where my office is, I did pachanga and had a lot of these outside gatherings with music and fajitas and tamales, whatever, you know, and lots of food and lots of entertainment. And then I had like one big wine and cheese to set off my campaign. Then I even sold tickets to a carne guisada plate and did that one at the park on the east side. So I kept doing both things, trying to get a good mix of people.
Did you do early voting or absentee voting?
Oh, yes. And that's where you win your races.
Volunteers or paid people?
All volunteers. Oh, there were a couple of people, I think, that I paid because I didn't know any better. And everyone said, you have to have these people. So, yeah, I was taken by a couple of politiqueros real early on. That was an interesting
experience. What's the going rate for politiqueros that get votes out?
About 50 to 100 a week before the election, and the actual day of the election, 150.
All right.
They can get pretty expensive.
All right. Mm-hmm. And you did that both times or just the first time?
Both times.
Even though you had no opponent the second time, you just
No,
bought
the
insurance?
Second time I... you mean in 1996?
Yes.
When I ran unopposed? No. Then I just had one big party for my workers who were all disappointed that they were not going to have to work. I was very glad. That's the best way to run is unopposed. But no, that's all I did.
How can you afford to be on the council when you get a token monthly payment?
We don't even get a token monthly
payment. Zero?
Zero.
How can you afford this?
I can't. I do it because it's a good public service. I like the publicity of being on the city council. It brings in some business, not a lot, because I don't do civil cases. So it doesn't bring in the, you know, I do criminal defense and I do family law. It brings in a lot of family law cases. But I deal a lot with poor people. So if I didn't run to get clients, and basically I don't. I ran because I saw what the city was doing and I like being involved in the political process.
How long are you going to stay on the council, or what's next?
I'm running again next year for the council.
What is it that you like about this?
I can see the results of our work very quickly.
All right, well, why don't you tell me what your greatest accomplishment has been to date and your biggest disappointment?
The biggest disappointment, I'll start with that, was trying to pass a $25 million bond issue, which I spearheaded. It was a dream that all of us on the council and the staff had. But we put in there our wish list of everything we wanted to see happen in the city. And this is always looking towards a project that we call 2020, where we have a lot of committees set up in the city that actually plan for the future. And so the $25 million would have put us exactly on target for the year 2020. It didn't pass. We had a group organized against us. The saddest part was it wasn't just the Anglos that we anticipated would be against us. There were a lot of Mexicanos that went against us, and simply for envidia. They didn't want to see us do it. You know, there were people that had been on the council before, Mexicanos, and hadn't done much, and they just didn't want us to do it.
You
want to
try again?
We passed an $8 million. We scaled it down and just got the necessities, and we passed that. But that wasn't the greatest accomplishment. The greatest accomplishment was the setting up of so many committees that actually look at what Edinburgh should be in the year 2020 and actually govern the city and bring recommendations to us. For example, on the environmental committee, we're now recycling, where we never thought that would happen in the city of Edinburgh. We've gone to canister pickup, the garbage pickup by big canister, so that people don't have, you know, a bunch of dirty trash cans. So those two things have been, you know, two of our greatest accomplishments. And of course, we've got a big water park that's going to bring in, we think, a lot of revenue to the city of Edinburgh and provide entertainment for our young people, because we have a big gang problem. And again, we have some naysayers saying, oh, it's going to dry up, you have a drought, what are y'all doing? And we're saying, you know, watch us. You know, we've got some vision here, and we're going on a real positive note.
I understand this is supposed to be the biggest thing in the state.
Super Splash.
Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a water park like no other. And it took very creative financing to get it done.
So is this a private developer, or the city's going to own it, or what's the arrangement? How did you pull this off?
The city doesn't own it, but there was legislation passed in the last legislative session that allowed us to form what's called a 4B corporation. We already had a 4A, which is economic development. And that money from the sales tax can only be used for economic development, buildings, whatever, infrastructure. But the 4B, as I understand it, any profits made through that can be used for anything that the city wants. And that's the beauty of it. So we created several boards that went out and used the city's designation to float the municipal bonds, sold them, and in fact, at the time of the sale, they went out to sell $21 million, and they had offers for $31 million. And so the bigger groups like Payne Webber bought all these bonds. So they're private investors who have invested their money in this water project. And there's a management company that will be managing it. And that's how it's going to work.
Okay. Well, tell me how you got started in politics. I mean, what got you here?
Let's see. I'd have to go all the way back to having been born here and being a first-generation Mexican-American. My father came from Los Herreras, Nuevo León. And all the time that we were growing up, I remember always having somebody in our house that was staying with us in the process of becoming a citizen and getting a job here and all of that. My father did that. And so we were always helping somebody else from Mexico come over here and become a U.S. citizen. And I remember learning about the political process, at least in terms of how the government operated, because my father, when I was 10 years old, had to study to become a citizen. And his English wasn't very good, so I would sit with him and I would study and I would talk to him about the presidents and remember the legislative group and the judicial and explaining those differences. So at an early age, I became interested from having to help my father. And then I remember the first political campaign that I became interested in was Kennedy versus Nixon. And the way that it happened was I think I was a sophomore in high school. And I remember all those rumors about the Pope was going to rule the United States. And I was a staunch Catholic, and I always have been. And so I was very offended at that. And so I debated someone at school. I was for Kennedy, and he was for Nixon.
This was high school?
Mm-hmm. So I remember that and becoming very interested in that, and I became very opinionated at that time and learned about the Democratic Party versus the Republican Party. So that I would have to say that that's where it started. And then when I graduated from high school, of course, your mind is somewhere else. I was 18 years old. No one told me that I needed to go to college, even though I was in the top 10% of my class. There were no counselors who encouraged me to go to college. My parents had no money. And so the only thing that was left for me to do was to find a man to marry. That's what I was supposed to do. Find someone to marry and take care of me. Get a little job. And that's what I did. I got a little job as a secretary at the high school where I graduated. And then met my husband there. He was a brand new school teacher and had a college degree. So I did what was expected. I'm, married him at age 21, moved to Houston, and proceeded to live my life the way I was supposed to, which was, have a little job, have my kids, and let my husband take care of me. When I had three kids and my husband had finally finished his PhD, I was 30 years old, and we moved back to the Valley. And that's when I heard a song one time on the radio, I'll never forget it. And it was Peggy Lee singing, "Is That All There Is?" And that song just kind of woke me up. Like, is this all there is? I have a house, I have a husband, I have three kids, I'm a secretary. Is that all there is? And so I started searching for something else. And so I went back to college at age 31. And I say I went back because I'd had a few hours right after high school, but they were typing and bookkeeping and shorthand, which were the things that I needed to get my little job. So at age 31, I came back to the Valley and went to Pan American University. I wasn't part of the UT system then, and started learning.
And did you come by yourself? You say, I came back.
No, all of us, the whole family moved down here to La Jolla, where my husband got his job as a superintendent. And I started going to college. And in 1982, I graduated, but with a political science degree. And that's where I really nurtured my love of politics. I took every course there was to take in politics. I took a course on Latin American politics, Mexican American politics, where we studied about you and the whole history of La Raza Unida. And I had been involved with La Raza Unida in Austin when we lived there, but very peripherally. In other words, we knew people who were really involved, and we'd go to the pachangas and we switched from Democrat to Raza Unida and voted, for the Raza Unida candidates when we were in Austin. I remember being chastised by Gonzalo Barrientos for doing that. And we marched with the farm workers in 1975. And again, all of those experiences encouraged me and kind of made me very curious about politics. And I developed a real love for it. And when I was in school and I actually studied the theory and the books and the history of the civil rights and the Mexicanos, well, you know, the rest is history. And I fell in love with it. And I got my political science degree and could not find a job because it's not a marketable degree. So I relied on my communications minor to get a job as a public relations officer with the school district where my husband worked. And there I did parental involvement and I did training, public speaking training with principals, and it was a fun job, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. And then in 1983, I was interviewed by Ernesto Cortez Jr. And he said to me, "Do you want to become a member of the most powerful group that will ever, you know, rise in the Rio Grande Valley?" And I said, "Well, sure, yes." That was the hook, you know. And that was my first exposure to Valley Interfaith, which is one of the IAF network organizations. And we did a lot of stuff. From 83 to 86, I was completely immersed in Valley Interfaith business. Again, all unpaid. There was one part where I got paid, and that was when Willie Velasquez came, and we contracted with him to do a six-month voter registration project. And we set the goal of registering 23,000 new voters from La Jolla to Brownsville. And we came pretty close. And we had every church, a group in every church, there were over 60 churches in the diocese then, doing voter registration every Sunday at church, before and after. And then on Sundays we'd go to parks and hit all the parks, and we'd go to the cheese lines because this was during the time that we had farm workers out of work because we'd had a freeze. And I mean, we just registered voters right and left. And that for that effort, I was paid $5,000 for the six-month period to organize it and coordinate it. But the rest of the time that I worked for Valley Interfaith, it was all for free. And
did you go to training, IAF training? Yes. And what was all that about?
We were sent to New York. Several these leaders, they categorized people in three groups: primary leaders, secondary leaders, tertiary leaders, always with the goal of taking the tertiary leaders and building them upward. I came in probably at a secondary leader designation, and I say that because I noticed the other people that were becoming recruited were your PhDs, like Dr. Juan Sanchez and Dr. Juliet Garcia, and people from the Brownsville area that had higher degrees. Remember, at this time I only had a BA. So we went to IAF training in New York. It was 10-day intensive training where Ernesto Cortez Jr. and all the other organizers began to disorganize us, and that's what they said. And they would take us into these workshops and they would say, "Who's the Chicano leader?" And who's, like your question, just like your questions began, what is a primary organization for Chicanos? And who's the primary leader? And then, and if we'd say Cesar Chavez, they'd say, "No, that's not right," you know, and they just threw us into a spin and started us rethinking electoral politics. And their whole goal was to have us to start thinking in terms of issue-oriented politics. What they call the real politics with a little p, the politics that dates back to Aristotle and, you know, all of those great Greek theorists. And it was very effective. For me, it was very effective. I came home and it was like I saw everything in a different light. I bought their whole theories. And I bought everything that they had to sell. I mean, I was prime. And you have to understand that at that time, I was a woman who was somewhat educated, but had always been treated as a secondary citizen. I never got to be a leader in anything. I always did the grunt work, the registering, the telephoning, and all of that. So for me, this organization was offering me leadership and status. And so I bought it all. And I remember my husband didn't go to the training, but went to some of the meetings, and he quickly dropped out and said, this is bull, you know. These people just want you to do what they want you to do. And I disagreed with him. And I understood, we had to read, I've never read so much in my life. We got a reading list of books. I wish I could find it. I haven't been able to find it. But we read from Brothers Karamazov to The Jungle, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, to The Grapes of Wrath, to American Dream, to the politics of power. I mean, you name it. There was a like 2-page list, and we had to read those books, and I read every single one of them. The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. And I was sold. I mean, I became a great leader in their eyes, and did everything that I was supposed to do, and I was obedient, and I challenged people, and I agitated, and I spoke for the organization. And then one day, I'll never forget it, one of the organizers, and it was Ernesto Cortez Jr., said, you know, you're not of the people. You're a prima donna. And the reason why this challenge took place was because we were asking for a new organizer, that the new organizer that was going to come, we wanted someone that would speak Spanish, because we were tired of the people from the colonias being translated to. And so I became the spokesperson for those people, and I was chastised for it because they wanted to send who they wanted to send. And the new organizer was an Anglo and didn't speak any Spanish. And see, we'd already had an Anglo who didn't speak Spanish. And so we thought it was time, and so we tried to turn the tables on them, and I guess they thought we got too big for our britches. I'll never forget that talk, because at that point I learned that I didn't have to buy everything they had to sell. That we had done a lot of good things, but it was probably time for me to move on. And so I did.
Valley Interfaith didn't become the most powerful organization in the Valley.
It became powerful, but no, I would have to say it didn't become the most powerful. But it has effectuated more changes than any other organization down here. And I'm very proud of the work that I did with Valley Interfaith. And it actually changed my life.
What happened next?
I went to law school.
Why'd you do that?
We moved out of the Valley, and we were in Houston, and it was like, I wanted to go back to school and get a political science master's or a doctorate. And I remember my husband sitting down with me and saying, now, what did we learn from the BA? It's not a marketable degree. So why are you then? And I said, because it's my true love. I love politics. I love going to classes about politics. He said, then go into the law. And it was he that put that seed in my mind. And my biggest obstacle was myself. I thought you had to be really, really intelligent, and that I could never pass that stupid LSAT, and I didn't know how it was scored. And so it took me 2 months to get the courage up to even go take the LSAT, and so I did, and I didn't score very well. And then I only applied to one college, one university, which was a stupid thing to do. But, you know, I said, okay, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. Stupid thing to do. I would never recommend anyone do that. But I got into the University of Houston. Because of my experience, because of my age, because of my grade point average when I was in college, which was very high because I went back as an older student, and then began the 3 hardest years of my life.
How old were you then when you started?
40. And it was sheer hell. That's the only way I can describe it. And I never thought I would make it through, but the turning point for me, I think everyone has a turning point in law school or anything difficult like that, where they decide, okay, I'm going to make it, or where they realize they're going to make it. And for me, it happened real early on, and it was within the first 2 months. I think we started at the end of August. In October, October 31, Halloween, my best friend died from breast cancer down here in the Valley. And that's got a picture of it. And I had to go home, or come home to talk at her funeral, to give a eulogy, because her mom asked me to. And when I went back, I went to the only professor that I thought would understand why I had missed 2 days. Because back then, if you missed 2 days, for example, out of contracts, you were kicked out of, 8 days, you were kicked out of the whole, not just contracts, but the whole program. So we guarded our absences really well. So when I came back, I was so worried that she had marked me, I went to Barbara White, our professor for contracts, a Jewish white woman from New York. I don't know why I thought she would understand. Stupid me. But I told her, I said, I had to be absent because my best friend died and I had to go home. And she turned to me and she said, oh, I forgot to mark you absent. And she marked me. And man, I was so upset. I just went to my little carrel, you know how they assigned us, and I just sat there and cried, and I thought to myself, okay, no one is going to help you. you're going to get your ass in here and study, and you're going to make it through. And for me, that was a turning point. After that, I didn't ask anyone for any help. I mean, other than, you know, some of my fellow students, and joined a group. I have to study in a group. I don't study well by myself. But that was, for me, that was what did it. I knew I was going to finish law school no matter what, because of their attitude. You know, they didn't want me there. They didn't want me because I was Mexicana, and they didn't want me because I was a woman. And that just made me more determined.
And older than the regular students, huh?
Older than the regular student, correct.
Was that a problem, fitting in with the younger ones?
Oh, yeah. I learned to drink beer in law school. I'm not proud of that, but I did that to try to fit in. It didn't work, you know. So eventually you find a place for yourself, and you just hunker down, and you get through it.
And then I guess you took the bar exam.
And then I took the bar exam, and I had a job with a federal judge waiting for me, which was nice, and that was because of my contacts down here. And then I didn't pass the first time, and I was working for Judge Vela, and I was devastated, and I cried for, oh God, 3 days. And Judge Vela sat me down and said, okay, so big deal. You know, you just take it over. It's just a small problem. And then my husband said, it's just a small inconvenience. You're going to take it and you're going to be fine. So I had a lot of people encouraging me. So I made it through. And then when I passed the second time, it was like, no big deal. And now nobody asks you, you know.
So did you practice in Houston, or did you go to work for the judge, or did you all move over here? And
I went to work for the judge in Brownsville, and he asked me what kind of cases I wanted to brief. And I've always been a constitutional law advocate. I took all the classes in constitutional law that you could take up there. So I briefed all those cases on police brutality and constitutional violations. But there's no ACLU office down here. There's really no office down here that you can actually, legal aid office for that matter. They were doing away with all of those. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed my clerking with him for 1 year, but when I actually started practice, I went with a small civil law firm of Ramon and Cantu, and I did just about everything that you can do in civil practice, from personal injury to defense work, and I enjoyed that. But again, at my age, and after working for over a year and a half for peanuts, I said, well, this is for the birds. So I opened my own office, and then I developed my own legal aid office, which is my office, and I do family practice, every kind of child custody cases you can think of, paternity cases, and I do criminal defense, appointed and retained. Now I'm starting to get some retained cases. It's hard when you're a woman. Most people that are accused of crimes don't have much faith, especially in our culture, in a woman attorney. They don't think we can be tough enough. So it's been hard building that reputation.
You've been in this location since you started?
No, I've been at this location 3 years now. But I initially officed with some experienced attorneys. I was no dummy. I was going to have some attorney that I could at least rely on. You know, when you get out of law school and you start practicing, and someone comes to you with a problem, it's not that easy to categorize. You don't say, oh, well, this is contract. Oh, well, this is criminal. Oh, well, this is personal. You know, so I needed someone to help me, and I officed with Brinkley Oxford, who had been our attorney for many years, grew up here in the Alton area, and he was a tremendous help. And I stayed there with him for about 2 years, and then I went on my own.
So how are you liking the practice of law?
I absolutely love practicing law. I think that this is what I was supposed to do with my life. You know, they say that you question yourself when you're in your 20s to early 20s and say, you know, what's my purpose in life? What should I do? For me, that didn't occur till I was 40. I was a late bloomer. And I can honestly tell you that this is what I was supposed to do with my life. I don't know if this is all I'm supposed to do, but this was the main thing I was supposed to do with my life. And I love it. And I'm going to keep doing it until it's no fun.
Well, you've got some great skills. You've got a lot of political capital under your belt, and a lot of economic and social capital. What are you going to do with all this? Are you going to run for another office? Are you going to organize a group? What are you going to do with all of this?
I don't know.
Have you thought about it?
Yes, I have. In fact, this year I turned 50, and I've been thinking about what the hell do I do now? Because it seems like my life, at least every 10 years, something major. At 20, you know, I decided to get married. At 30, I went back to college. At 40, I went to law school, and now I'm 50. It's like time to do something new. And I fight against people encouraging me constantly to run for judge. I'm very reluctant to run for judge for many reasons, but the main reason is that I think everyone starts with the best of intentions, but I think the nature of that job is such that you just can't keep to your principles. At some point, you've got to give something. You've got to compromise, and that's scary for me. I don't like to compromise. I don't like to give. I don't like to, move that little line a little bit further on, you know?
You're talking about ethics and
ethics,
values, not
yes.
negotiations of a business deal or...
Ethics, you know, and values, exactly.
Priorities and that sort of
thing. Right. It's a very, it's a job that's very seducing, and I'm not above being seducible, and that worries me. And Idaho County has a problem with the perception of corruption. I don't think all our judges are corrupt. I think some of our judges are very hardworking and have still that love for la gente. And I support those judges, and I work for them very, very hard. But there is that perception, and that's, I don't know if I want to run for judge or not. I like the practice of law.
Do you think that women are still discriminated against in the electoral arena?
Yes.
In which ways?
I think that some of the older politicos, the people that you must rely on, like even in a local race, still perceive women as maybe sometimes not being as tough, sometimes being too nice. But if you're not too nice and if you're real tough, then you're gotcha. And gotcha to me is a translation of bitch in English. I just helped and worked real hard for Rose Guerra Reyna. I was one of her campaign managers.
Who was she running?
Judge. She's elected.
District judge.
District judge. Judge Evans is the outgoing judge. And that was a vacancy. Okay. And a lot of people pushed me to run for that, but I didn't feel ready because I didn't know if I wanted to, first of all. And secondly, money-wise, I don't have money to run for judge. And to run for judge in Hidalgo County, you have to put in a lot of your money. We're talking $150,000, not of your own money, but that you have to raise. Rose, for example, sent out a letter recently. She has a $77,000 debt, all right? And she won. Imagine the person who lost. So for many reasons, I decided not to run, but I wanted to make sure that a good person got in there. So I worked real hard for her. Now as one of her campaign managers. And we went everywhere, and we met everybody and all kinds of people. And the most constant problem that we had were from the older gentlemen, Mexicanos, who didn't like women being out at night. A lot of times we wore pants, you know, and boots because we went out to, you know, ranch areas. And it's this perception that it's not ladylike, that we have to fight a lot. The women loved us, and there are a lot of women voters. And then there are a lot of men that accept us as equals, and that's why we won. But it was hard. Even my own husband, who I think has come a long way, is like, you know, why do you have to be out every night? And, you know, every weekend you've got something. And I say, don't you understand the luxury that I have? This is what I love, politics. And here I have a woman candidate that I can be with till all hours of the night, and no one's going to say, well, you know what they're doing, right? Because the three of us, the other campaign manager and myself and Rose, all married and have families, so they couldn't call us lesbians, they couldn't call us whores. We were just women, you know, politicking. And it was great.
Did you hear some of those epithets?
Oh, yeah. You still get the criticism. You have to just develop a...
How about on the council? There you share governance. You got to work with others. How many members on the council?
There's five of us with the mayor. Four
all right,
council members.
So you got to get at least three
right.
others.
Right.
Or, yeah, sort of. Does the mayor vote all the time?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does.
So you got to get three others to
yes.
look at it your way.
Yes.
What are the dynamics? How do you do that?
This council is easy for me because there are people that know me and respect me and vice versa. We have Arnold Benavides, who is the newest member of the council, and he's a principal and worked under my husband as superintendent, and is just loves what he does and is not threatened at all by someone like me. We've got Roy Pena, who is a pharmaceutical salesman, and very, very busy in his job, and so he loves for people to brief him and tell him what's going on, because he doesn't have that luxury to always be hands-on. We've got Fred Longoria, who's an older gentleman, but has been married twice and has a younger wife who runs a business, and so he's not threatened by someone like me, and I get along just fine with him, and he's a friend of my father's. And then, of course, the mayor, whose wife is a financial advisor and runs his business, and is just a very modern type of person. So I have the best possible council at this time. And we had one other woman on the council, an Anglo woman that we all put in there to try to be inclusive of a segment of our community. Well, that didn't work. It didn't work. And so we decided not to support her, and she decided not to run, and then we put another person in. It's hard getting Mexicanas to run for these positions.
Now, you alluded to this X group that had put other people in. Does it have a name, or these are old former members,
or is it
the old party?
We have the old guard Mexicanos, and we're talking about, can I mention names?
Sure.
Okay. We're talking about...
Well, you're the lawyer as well. The truth is a defense.
It is. We're talking about the De La Garzas and the Alamias and the Champions and the De La Viñas, certain Mexicano families who were educated before our families were, because they went back more generations. They've been here more generations. And so they're the ones that had gotten elected after the last Anglos. Okay, and for some reason, they decided to keep the city small and in a no-growth pattern, and we just didn't see that as beneficial, especially to all our new residents. And so this group that's in right now is a younger group, with my exception, of course, but it's a younger group in terms of these people come from the barrio and they're educated and they have now kind of taken over. And so there's an old group that doesn't really like everything that we're doing because it makes them look bad. Then there's the old Anglo group, and I don't mean old, but the Anglo segment of our population, which will never like us because we're in power now, and so they don't have a say-so, and they don't like the fact that these young upstarts are now calling the shots.
Are you the oldest person on the council?
Yes. Well, no, Fred Longoria is 60. But the other members are pretty young. They're in their early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great council.
Okay. Do you belong to any associations or women's caucus groups or any organizations at all, LULAC or NALEO or any of that?
I'm a member of NALEO, and I belong to the Women's Bar and the Hidalgo County Bar, and we're about to form an Hispanic chamber in the city, which I thought was funny since we're all Hispanic down here and yet we don't have TAMAC operating. And they finally decided to come here and organize, so we're forming that. I'm a member of the Chamber of Commerce. I'm a member of the Hidalgo County Boot Camp Advisory Council, which is a boot camp that houses young offenders, nonviolent offenders, from the age of 17 to 25. I'm a member of the Southwest Key Corporation, which is a nonprofit that deals with adjudicated juveniles. And I've sat on their board since 1988. And what other group? That's about it.
But other than TAMAC, no Chicano groups?
No Chicano groups, no. We started a women's political caucus, back in 1983, but that's kind of gone by the wayside. You know, again, we couldn't, the Mexicanas and the gringas couldn't really work together. We have different issues, different cultures. It just didn't work.
What are some of those differences?
Well, for example, we found out in forming the Women's Political Caucus that the Anglo women liked us fine as long as we were the battered women and the victims, right? But if we were women on the same level as them, it wasn't the same. And so we had those kinds of problems, vying for leadership. Who's going to run the organization? Well, you know, just because we're Mexicanas, we didn't want to be the grunts. I mean, that already happened to us with the Mexicano organizations like Mexican-American Democrats. So we fought real hard for the leadership. And so one year, a Mexicana would be president, and the next year, a gringa would get it. You know what I mean? Because enough Mexicanos would vote for that for that angle. So, you know, eventually it kind of just disbanded. And then there still is a Women's Political Caucus, and it's Puras Mexicanas, but it's just not the same as when we started it back in 83. Oh, they'll get together once in a while and endorse candidates, but that's about it. They don't really do anything else.
I'm curious because you keep describing Edinburgh as being all Hispanic, yet you said you have a Chamber of Commerce, and you're starting a Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. So the Chamber of Commerce is all white?
No, it's not all white. It's a good mixture. But you have to understand that the Anglos that are still in Edinburgh and are still in the Valley, they really control all the economic, they have the economic power. And it's the same thing in the Chamber. And they may not all be Anglos, but there are Mexicanos that I consider Anglos on the Chamber. And so our East Side Mexicano business owners, they don't join that Chamber. The ones that join that Chamber are those of us that can kind of fit in both groups. And so the way I see it, as a city official, we need another, there's a need for a Chamber that will address the smaller business owner, the Mexicano on the East Side. So I think it's a good thing.
You said you had a gang problem. What are your thoughts on the basis and the origins and the causes of all of this?
Oh, gosh.
The schools are in a mess?
It's such a complicated issue. I don't believe that our schools are meeting the needs of our Chicano kids. And I still like to use the word Chicano because that's what they are. I think that...
Is that what you call yourself?
Yes. I prefer to call myself a Chicano. Of course, sometimes people frown, so I use Mexican-American. It depends on the group I'm with. With you, I feel comfortable saying it. But what I see happening is that the schools aren't meeting the needs of these Chicano kids. And I'm not talking about recent immigrants only. I'm talking about the kids that still have to migrate and come back and come into school with certain needs. And so since the school doesn't meet their needs, a lot of times they're troublemakers or they don't listen in class, and for whatever reason they're sent to an alternative setting, which now the law mandates, and they hang together and they go where they feel comfortable, and they feel comfortable with other kids like themselves. No one in the Rio Grande Valley has ever made an attempt to try to go and talk to these kids and form either a meeting place or an organization that will allow them to be a part. The Boys and Girls Club has tried to do that, but it hasn't been successful. And I don't know what it is that we're going to have to do, but these kids are not succeeding in school, and for that reason they're banding together. They feel a need to band together and run around with kids that accept them. They're from poor families, they don't have much, and yet they see a lot of other people with a lot of things. And you know, how do gangs form? They have a need to belong to something. We have a lot of single parent families because out of necessity the men have to go work, or you know, people don't get married nowadays. We have people that just decide to live together and then it's so easy to split up. I mean, I don't know what to tell you about how to solve the problem. I can tell you what the problem is. And a lot of it is not the kid's fault. And I represent a lot of juveniles, and so I see this on a daily basis. The minute I see a kid in here with a long rap sheet, I can tell you right away he probably just has one parent, and it's the mother. And that's who appears with me in court with that kid, is the mother. And she's receiving food stamps and whatever else. And if she's not, she's struggling to make a living. And she's got three or four other kids.
Let me switch a little bit and ask you, what is leadership?
Leadership is when a person has the ability to get other people to do what you want them to do. That's how I define leadership.
Okay. Can we get into a little biography here in terms of, you mentioned, I think the only names was your parents, I believe, one set of parents.
Yes.
Or one side. You've mentioned the husband with no name, you've mentioned the children with no names.
Okay.
Can you give us origins here?
Sure.
Who is Ofelia Los Santos in that context?
Okay.
Genealogy.
My father is Juan Garza Leal, and when he came over to the United States in 1925, he had to change his name to Juan Leal Garza. Because remember, your mother's name cannot be last. That's the first thing they tell us.
Here.
Here in the United States. So he became Juan Leal Garza. He was a, not a bracero, but like a bracero. He wasn't a formal bracero. And I'm referring to the bracero program where the United States would recruit labor from Mexico. He came over here right at the end of, did I say 1945? 1945. He came over here because they needed workers down here in the valley. And he swam across illegally. So he was a mojado. And he boarded at a certain house here in Edinburgh on 18th Street, not too far from here. And that's that was my grandmother's boarding house. And that's where he met my mother. My mother was is Eloisa Garza, well, Dimas, maiden name, Garza, married name. And she was 14 years old. And my grandmother said, if you marry this man or if you run off with him, I'm going to, you know, spank you within an inch of your life. And my mother said, fine, but I'm going to marry him anyway. So at age 15, she was married to my father, who was 25 at the time. And to this day, my mother says that he married her to become a citizen. And that's probably more true than not. But he was a good husband, and he loved her. He fell in love with her. They had to go back to Mexico for a year. And I was born when she was 18 years old, and after she lost two other kids. And my father wanted a boy so bad that when I was born, he just pretended I was a boy. And so I went everywhere with him. He was a carnicero. And I worked at Adeguello, killed the cows, skinned the pigs, and did all of that that has to do with slaughtering of cattle and pigs. And so I used to go with him to the Chiquita. I had my little boots, and I was real bow-legged, and they used to call me La Cowgirl. And I went with him. And my dad was my first strong role model. I wanted to be just like him. I love my dad very much. He's 79 years old right now, and he and my mom are separated. But in any case, I'm a firstborn, very ambitious, just very determined, and I get that from my dad and the way he treated me. Then when, again, I lived with them, with my parents all the way through school until I was 19, when I actually lived on my own for a while because they went to California. And that's when I met my husband. And so I went directly from my dad and my mom to my husband, Miguel Angel de los Santos, who's from Edinburgh. And I met him as a school teacher. And he was my second strongest role model.
Oh, you didn't know him here?
No. Because when I was six, we moved to Far, and I grew up in Far and went to school over there. And he's 3 years older. I met him, yeah, when I was 19 and he was 22, I think. And I had some teachers that were good role models for me, don't get me wrong, but I consider my father and then my husband my two strongest role models because they're the ones who made me who I am today, really and truly. My father, because he taught me how to work hard and how to help other people always that were coming through our home, and my husband, because he's the one that got me involved in politics and encouraged me to go back to school and encouraged me to go to law school and has supported me in my running for office and everything else. And of course helped me raise my kids.
Did you ever meet grandparents?
My grandmother, on my mother's side, Luz Gomez, was perhaps a very strong matriarch type person. I realize it now as I look back. I used to spend summers with her. She was a single parent, having reared 13 children and lost two husbands. She was very strong, and she was a foster parent. From the time I was 10 years old, I used to come and spend weekends with her, and she was a foster parent for juveniles. And so I would get to find out all the stuff that bad kids did, and I loved it. I thought it was so exciting, you know. It was my way of knowing what the other side of life was like. And so from my grandmother, I think I learned a lot of también about helping, you know, kids in trouble. My other grandparents I never met on my father's side. They died before I was old enough to know them.
You said that you lost two siblings, but were there other members? Were you the only child remaining, or what?
No, I'm the oldest of five. I have a sister named Oralia, who's named Oralia, and she follows me by 1 year, and then my sister Lelia, she's 1 year behind Oralia, and then my brother Alejandro, my only brother, and then my sister Sylvia. So I have three sisters and one brother.
And where are they?
Oralia and I are the only college educated ones, and she lives in Far and has three kids of her own, and they've all grown up and are out of the house. Lelia, my third sister, graduated from high school and had a series of terrible relationships. And she's an alcoholic. And she drinks starting at 9 o'clock in the morning till, you know, 9 o'clock at night. And she doesn't work. And she has no children. And doesn't come to our family gatherings anymore. But I love her dearly. And then Sylvia, my third sister, is unemployed at the time, but she's had two marriages, has a high school education, and has two children. And she's relatively okay. I say that because from time to time she has a major crisis. My brother Alejandro is a salesperson for a big Western wear place in McAllen. He's been there for years. He's the salt of the earth, has about 60 hours of college. I could never get him to graduate. Always said, why did he want to work so hard? And when I offered him, you know, come and live with us and go to college, he said, ¿Para qué quiero ser tanta cosa tan grande? So he's very satisfied with his lot in life, which is to be an 8-to-5 and no responsibilities. He has a wife and one child.
And then you have children. Who are they and where are they?
I have three children. My oldest is 28, and she's Patricia Lopez now. She has one child, my two-year-old grandson, and she teaches at the university. She's an instructor in early childhood. Then my second daughter, at Pan American University, University of Texas Pan American. And Araceli just graduated from Pan American and is going to be a kindergarten teacher here at one of our local schools in Edinburgh. She's 22, unmarried, and I think she's going to be a lawyer someday. She's just getting her feet wet. Very opinionated, very combative, reminds me a lot of me. And we're like this, so we're always, you know, butting heads. But she's just like me, looks like me, acts like me, all that. Then my son, Miguel, is 20. In fact, their birthdays are this week. He's 20, he's a golfer, has no ambition other than to, you know, slide by college and be a pro golfer someday. I worry about him. He wants to be that's his ambition in life, to be like a pro golfer at some country club.
Is he any good?
He's very good. He's gotten a scholarship for his junior year, and he's playing in a tournament this weekend in San Antonio, and I'm supposed to go see him. But his degree is going to be in business, and I hope he can sell anything to anybody, so I'm hoping that he will get a job and will be self-sufficient someday. He still lives at home.
I've never seen a vaquero dressed golfer. And I've seen him a few times, and he got all the garb. I would never imagine that he's in the golf.
He's also a Mexican cowboy and loves country western music, but now he's developed a taste for Tejano music, thank God. Speaks Spanish, he's fluent. All of our kids are fluent in Spanish, and I'm very proud of that. And moving back to the Valley was one of the reasons why we did that. And they're proud of their heritage. And I think that all of my kids are a little embarrassed at having such a publicity-seeking mom. Yeah.
Well, you know, we hurried along because we had this crisis with the wiring and the battery. I run out of questions. Is there something that you want to talk about? Do you go to women's leadership conferences, or do you work on self-help kind of programs, or do you...
No.
Have you adopted a juvenile delinquent girl and helping her out? Do you fundraise for scholarships? What do you do, or what do you want to say here toward the end of this interview?
I think what I would want to say for whomever is reading this or listening to this is that there is nothing that I have accomplished that could have been accomplished without the strong faith that I have in God. And that I got from my mom. I haven't mentioned my mom very much. My mom and I don't get along very well. She's a strong woman, but she's an old-fashioned woman. And she won't admit that Women's Lib has helped her. And I think that on the one hand, she's proud of me for what I've done, but she's also very disapproving. So I've always had this conflict with my mom. But what I credit my mom the most for is giving me such a strong faith in God. It got me through my childbirth years. It got me through my kids' adolescent years. It got me through law school. It got me through a hysterectomy in law school. it got me through so many difficult moments. And I remember being in philosophy class and being told that religion is a crutch and, you know, all of that. And I'm so glad I didn't buy that, because I don't care if it is a crutch. I can't make it through life without religion or without my faith. And I'm talking about my Catholic faith. And when people ask me why I don't run for judge, when I talk to people that I trust, that I think will understand, I tell them that I don't see being a judge as helping me on my path towards becoming a better person. And at my age, at 50, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to become a better person. And it's hard. It's really hard, not just in this profession, but you know, living down here, it's hard to be a good person because it's so easy to get jaded and to take money from people because you may not collect from your next client. And it's so hard to continue doing the kind of work that you need to do, like representing the person who is very undesirable and very unpleasant to be around. And always having to remind yourself that look for the divine in that person. That's hard. And I represent a lot of mentally ill people, and I just pray through those cases because it's so hard sometimes. They'll spit at you, they will say horrible things, they will do embarrassing things, and yet somebody's got to represent them. And I credit my faith with allowing me to practice a ministry that I think is very, very important. There aren't many lawyers that do the kind of work that some of us do down here in the valley, and there's such a need. All the legal aid offices are closed. The one that's here is practically gutted. It's worthless. There's no pro bono. I mean, the lawyers talk about pro bono every year, but very few lawyers do pro bono. And I just wish that there was a way to shake everybody up and say, hey, you know, this is what it's all about. Remember that oath that you took? Remember why you wanted to go to law school? I cannot believe that people just wanted to go to law school to make money. At some point, they must have been inspired to do something besides just to make money.
Are you saying that Texas Rural Legal Aid is out of business in Weslaco?
Hey, what do they do? I have people all the time coming and telling me that they won't accept their cases. They're very restricted in what kind of cases they can take, even divorce cases. Forget criminal cases, but even divorce cases they can't. It's awful. And my secretary one day jokingly said to me, you know, you ought to just put up a sign that says legal aid office. And I sat down with her and I talked to her about why I did the kind of work. Sometimes you do the kind of work that you do and you think people just understand it. And sometimes even your family and your staff don't. And so I sat down with her and we had one of those, you know, come to a meeting, meeting of the minds. And she never made that comment again.
Knowing the legal system as you do, can the poor get justice?
Only if they get a lawyer like me.
That doesn't charge them.
Yes. And that really cares. Now, we lost a really good lawyer last night in a car accident. Oscar Fuentes, he was one of our type of lawyers. He took the indigent cases. And if he couldn't collect, that was fine. And he fought the state every step of the way and defended their rights, constitutional and otherwise. And I really admired him because he was an older lawyer still doing that kind of work. And we lost him last night, and I was real saddened to hear that.
How did the Chicano movement help women, Chicanas?
Oh, it helped a lot.
How?
Again, because women were allowed to take leadership roles in that organization and actually run for office, and they became elected officials for the first time in their hometowns. And
are you talking about the Raza Unida party, or I said Chicano movement, but you're talking about an organization?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I switched to La Raza Unida. Yes.
Oh, so you're talking about the Raza Unida.
Yes.
Okay.
The Chicano movement itself, there was a lot of awareness. People in universities and colleges started talking about the Mexican-American experience and started to make comparisons with those of the blacks. And some people may not like to be compared to the black history, but I think it's very relevant. I think that in a lot of ways we wrote those coattails, just like the women rights movement rode the coattails of these other two civil rights movements. So in terms of making people aware of problems, I think the Chicano movement did that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it spread like wildfire. It even hit the valley, which everyone says always gets everything late. Unfortunately, I was in 1969, I was newly married, and that was like the furthest thing from my mind was getting involved in a movement. So it kind of like, you know, bypassed me as I was headed in another direction. But then I became involved after that.
Why do you think the Valley area is more conservative and so chronically devastated economically and in terms of high unemployment and everybody accepts that as normal?
I think the main reason is that the economic power is still in the hands of the people who came and raped this area. I'm talking about the Bensons and the McAllens and the people that originally, you know, took over the land grants that the King of Spain, you know, had given out and married with the Rebecca Valles and the, you know, the other women from those old Spanish families. They still have that economic power. They still own the banks. They still run the chambers of commerce. And so it's to their benefit and the produce companies. I mean, we just toppled Offal Brand a year ago. It's still to their benefit to have a large pool of unskilled labor.
Does the city subsidize the Chamber of Commerce?
We give them some money for their budget, yes. Not much, but we...
And in terms of contracting and the professional service, like investment bankers and the contracted legal counsel and so on, are those Mexicans that you hire, or are there Anglos?
The city attorneys at this point are, it's an Anglo firm, but has been taken over by a bigger firm, and one of the partners is a Hispanic woman. But our bond attorneys, for example, on this water park, they're Hispanics. Estrada Hinojosa out of Dallas.
You briefly mentioned an involvement with the Mexican Democrats. When was that? What did you do? And you know that they have split. What are your views on that?
Mexican American Democrats, I would have to say that my involvement began in Austin in the early 70s. And that was when I mentioned Gonzalo Barrientos, who's been, a state rep, now a senator, and out of Austin for years. We belonged to Mexican American Democrats, went to the meetings. Again, I was, usually on the doing the phone bank, walking, passing out materials. I was never an officer or anything like that. In La Jolla, in 1979, when we joined Mexican American Democrats, same thing. I mean, we'd go to the state meetings and go to the local meetings, and again, I was never an officer or anyone. So no, I don't think much of the organization. I think it had its purpose, and I think it did a lot of good, but for me personally, I mean, I learned from being there, and I learned about party politics.
Do you know what they split into?
I know, yeah. What's Richard Moya and
Well, Gonzalo Barrientos is the head of the other group, Tejano Democrats.
Wasn't it originally Al Luna who had split off?
No. Well, there may have been some
Richard
factions
Moya,
earlier on, but no, not too long ago here, MAD split into two, Tejano Democrats and Mexican Democrats. Roberto Alonso was head of Mexican Democrats, and Gonzalo objected to his reelection, so.
I haven't gone to those meetings since, I'd have to say, the early 80s.
Okay. Well, again, I've run out of questions.
And the tape is still running.
The battery is still going strong, so we will cut while we're ahead.
Okay,
thank you, Commissioner De Los Santos. It's great to see you again, and this is you're happy doing what you're doing.
Thanks. It's been great being interviewed by you.